but it was empty now, and the sunlight dusted the front of the ancient tower and showed up the blurred carvings beside the doorway. Human-like figures with folded wings, their features eroded by centuries of weather, but somehow in their stillness expressing power and compassion and intellectual force.
Angels,
said Pantalaimon, now a cricket on Lyra's shoulder.
Maybe spectres.
No, they said this was something angelly. Bet that's angels.
Shall we go in?
They looked up at the great oak door on its ornate black hinges. The half-dozen steps up to it were deeply worn, and the door itself stood slightly open. There was nothing to stop Lyra from going in except her own fear. She tiptoed to the top of the steps and looked through the opening. A dark, stone-flagged hall was all she could see, and not much of that. But Pantalaimon was fluttering anxiously on her shoulder, just as he had when they'd played the trick on the skulls in the crypt at Jordan College, and she was a little wiser now. This was a bad place. She ran down the steps and out of the square, making for the bright sunlight of the Palm Tree Boulevard. And as soon as she was sure there was no one looking, she went straight across to the window and threw into Will's Oxford. 40 minutes later, she was inside the physics building once more, arguing with the porter. But this time she had a trump card.
You just ask Dr. Malone. That's all you got to do. Ask her. She'll tell you.
The porter turned to his telephone, and Lyra watched pityingly as he pressed the buttons and spoke into it. That didn't even give him a proper lodge to sit in, like a real Oxford college. Just a big wooden counter, as if it was a shop.
All right. She says go on up. Mind you don't go anywhere else.
No, I won't.
She said demurely, a good little girl doing what she was told. At the top of the stairs, though, she had a surprise, because just as she passed a door with a symbol indicating woman on it, it opened, and there was Dr. Malone silently beckoning her in. She entered, puzzled. This wasn't the laboratory, it was a washroom, and Dr. Malone was agitated.
Lyra! There's someone else in the lab, police officers or something. They know you came to see me yesterday. I don't know what they're after, but I don't like it.
What's going on? How do they know I came to see you?
I don't know. They didn't know your name, but I knew who they meant.
Oh, well, I can lie to them. That's easy.
But what is going on?
A woman's voice spoke from the corridor outside.
Dr. Malone, have you seen the child?
Yes. I was just showing her where the washroom is.
There was no need for her to be so anxious, thought Lyra, but perhaps she wasn't used to danger. The woman in the corridor was young and dressed very smartly, and she tried to smile when Lyra came out, but her eyes remained hard and suspicious.
Hello. You're Lyra, are you?
Yeah. What's your name?
I'm Sergeant Clifford. Come along in.
Lyra thought this young woman had a nerve, acting as if it were her own laboratory, but she nodded meekly. That was the moment when she first felt the twinge of regret. She knew she shouldn't be here. She knew what the alethiometer wanted her to do, and it was not this. She stood doubtfully in the doorway. In the room already there was a tall, powerful man with white eyebrows. Lyra knew what scholars looked like, and neither of these two was a scholar.
Come in, Lyra. It's all right. This is Inspector Walters.
Hello, Lyra. I've been hearing all about you from Dr. Malone here. I'd like to ask you a few questions, if that's all right.
What sort of questions?
Nothing difficult. Come and sit down, Lyra.
He pushed a chair towards her. Lyra sat down carefully and heard the door close itself. Dr. Malone was standing nearby. Pantalaimon, cricket formed in Lyra's breast pocket, was agitated. She could feel him against her breast and hoped the tremor didn't show. She thought to him to keep still.
Where'd you come from, Lyra?
If she said Oxford, they'd easily be able to check. But she couldn't say another world, either. These people were dangerous. They'd want to know more at once. She thought of the only other name she knew of in this world, the place Will had come from.
Winchester.
You've been in the wars, haven't you, Lyra? How did you get those bruises? There's a bruise on your cheek and another on your leg. Has someone been knocking you about?
No.
Do you go to school, Lyra?
Yeah, sometimes.
Well, shouldn't you be at school today?
She said nothing. She was feeling more and more uneasy. She looked at Dr. Malone, whose face was tight and unhappy.
I just came here to see Dr. Malone.
Are you staying in Oxford, Lyra? Where are you staying?
With some people. Just friends.
What's their address?
I don't know exactly what it's called. I can find it easy, but I can't remember the name of the street.
Well, who are these people?
Just friends of my father.
I see. How did you find Dr. Malone?
'Cause my father's a physicist, and he knows her.
It was going more easily now, she thought. She began to relax into it and lie more fluently.
And she showed you what she was working on, did she?
Yeah, the engine with the screen. Yes, all that.
You're interested in that sort of thing, are you? Science and so on?
Yeah, physics especially.
You're going to be a scientist when you grow up?
That sort of question deserved a blank stare, which it got. He wasn't disconcerted. His pale eyes looked briefly at the young woman and then back to Lyra.
And were you surprised at what Dr. Malone showed you?
Well, sort of, but I knew what to expect.
Because of your father?
Yeah, because he's doing the same kind of work.
Yes, quite. Do you understand it?
Some of it.
Your father's looking into dark matter, then?
Yes.
Has he got as far as Dr. Malone?
Not in the same way. He can do some things better, but that engine with the words on the screen, he hasn't got one of those.
Is Will staying with your friends as well?
Yes, he...
And she stopped. She knew at once she'd made a horrible mistake. So did they, and they were on their feet in a moment to stop her from running out, but somehow Dr. Malone was in the way and the sergeant tripped and fell, blocking the way of the inspector. It gave Lyra time to dart out, slam the door shut behind her, and run full tilt for the stairs. Two men in white coats came out of a door, and she bumped into them. Suddenly Pantalaimon was a crow, shrieking and flapping, and he startled them so much they fell back, and she pulled free of their hands and raced down the last flight of stairs into the lobby, just as the porter put the phone down and lumbered along behind his counter, calling out,
"Oi! Stop there, you!"
But the flap he had to lift was at the other end, and she got to the revolving door before he could come out and catch her. And behind her the lift doors were opening, and the pale-haired man was running out, so fast, so strong. And the door wouldn't turn. Pantalaimon shrieked at her. They were pushing the wrong side. She cried out in fear and turned herself around, hurling her little weight against the heavy glass, willing it to turn, and got it to move just in time to avoid the grasp of the porter, who then got in the way of the pale-haired man, so Lyra could dash out and away before they got through. Across the road, ignoring the cars, the brakes, the squeal of tires, into this gap between tall buildings, and then another road with cars from both directions. But she was quick, dodging bicycles, always with the pale-haired man just behind her. Oh, he was frightening. Into a garden, over a fence, through some bushes, Pantalaimon skimming overhead, a swift, calling to her which way to go, crouching down behind a coal bunker as the pale man's footsteps came racing past, and she couldn't hear him panting, he was so fast and so fit. And Pantalaimon said,
"Back now! Go back to the road!"
So she crept out of her hiding place and ran back across the grass, out through the garden gate, into the open spaces of the Banbury Road again. And once again she dodged across, and once again tires squealed on the road. And then she was running up Norham Gardens, a quiet, tree-lined road of tall Victorian houses near the park. She stopped to gain her breath. There was a tall hedge in front of one of the gardens, with a low wall at its foot, and she sat there tucked closely in under the privet.
"She helped us. Dr. Malone got in their way. She's on our side, not theirs."
"Oh, Pan, I shouldn't have said that about Will. I should have been more careful."
"Shouldn't have come."
"I know, that too."
But she hadn't got time to berate herself because Pantalaimon fluttered to her shoulder and then said,
"Look out! Behind!"
And immediately changed to a cricket again and dived into her pocket. She stood, ready to run, and saw a large dark blue car gliding silently to the pavement beside her. She was braced to dart in either direction, but the car's rear window rolled down, and there looking out was a face she recognized.
"Lizzie,"
said the old man from the museum.
"How nice to see you again. Can I give you a lift anywhere?"
And he opened the door and moved up to make room beside him. Pantalaimon nipped her breast through the thin cotton, but she got in at once, clutching the rucksack, and the man leaned across her and pulled the door shut.
"You look as if you're in a hurry. Where do you want to go?"
"Up Summertown, please."
The driver was wearing a peaked cap. Everything about the car was smooth and soft and powerful, and the smell of the old man's cologne was strong in the enclosed space. The car pulled out from the pavement and moved away with no noise at all.
"So, what have you been up to, Lizzie? Did you find out more about those skulls?"
"Yeah,"
she said, twisting to see out of the rear window. There was no sign of the pale-haired man. She'd got away, and he'd never find her now she was safe in a powerful car with a rich man like this. She felt a little hiccup of triumph.
"I made some inquiries, too. An anthropologist friend of mine tells me that they've got several others in the collection, as well as the ones on display. Some of them are very old indeed. Neanderthal, you know."
"Yeah, that's what I heard too,"
Lyra said, with no idea what he was talking about.
"And how's your friend?"
"What friend?"
said Lyra, alarmed. Had she told him about Will, too?
The friend you're staying with.
Oh, yes, she's very well, thank you.
What does she do? Is she an archaeologist?
Oh, she's a physicist. She studies dark matter,
said Lyra, still not quite in control. In this world, it was harder to tell lies than she'd thought. And something else was nagging at her. This old man was familiar in some long-lost way, and she just couldn't place it.
Dark matter? How fascinating. I saw something about that in the Times this morning. The universe is full of this mysterious stuff, and nobody knows what it is. And your friend is on the track of it, is she?
Yes, she knows a lot about it.
And what are you going to do later on, Lizzie? Are you going in for physics too?
I might. It depends.
The chauffeur coughed gently and slowed the car down.
Well, here we are in Summertown. Where would you like to be dropped?
Oh, just up past these shops. I can walk from there. Thank you.
Turn left into South Parade and pull up on the right, could you, Alan?
Very good, sir.
A minute later, the car came to a silent halt outside a public library. The old man held open the door on his side so that Lyra had to climb past his knees to get out. There was a lot of space, but somehow it was awkward, and she didn't want to touch him, nice as he was.
Don't forget your rucksack,
he said, handing it to her.
Thank you.
I'll see you again, I hope, Lizzie. Give my regards to your friend.
Goodbye,
she said, and lingered on the pavement till the car had turned the corner and gone out of sight before she set off towards the hornbeam trees. She had a feeling about that pale-haired man, and she wanted to ask the alethiometer. Will was reading his father's letters again. He sat on the terrace hearing the distant shouts of children diving off the harbour mouth, and read the clear handwriting on the flimsy airmail sheets, trying to picture the man who'd penned it, and looking again and again at the reference to the baby, to himself. He heard Lyra's running footsteps from some way off. He put the letters in his pocket and stood up, and almost at once Lyra was there, wild-eyed, with Pantalaimon a snarling, savage wildcat, too distraught to hide. She who seldom cried was sobbing with rage. Her chest was heaving, her teeth were grinding, and she flung herself at him, clutching his arms, and cried,
"Kill him! Kill him! I want him dead! I wish Yorick was here! Oh, Will, I've done wrong! I'm so sorry!"
"What? What's the matter?"
"That old man! He ain't nothing but a low thief! He stole it, Will! He stole my alethiometer! That stinky old man with his rich clothes and his servant driving the car! Oh, I've done such wrong things this morning! Oh, I..."
And she sobbed so passionately he thought that hearts really did break, and hers was breaking now, for she fell to the ground wailing and shuddering, and Pantalaimon beside her became a wolf and howled with bitter grief. Far off across the water, children stopped what they were doing and shaded their eyes to see. Will sat down beside Lyra and shook her shoulder.
"Stop! Stop crying! Tell me from the beginning. What old man? What happened?"
"You're going to be so angry. I promised I wouldn't give you away. I promised it. And then..."
She sobbed, and Pantalaimon became a young, clumsy dog with lowered ears and wagging tail, squirming with self-abasement. And Will understood that Lyra had done something that she was too ashamed to tell him about, and he spoke to the demon.
"What happened? Just tell me."
"We went to the scholar, and there was someone else there, a man and a woman, and they tricked us. They asked a lot of questions, and then they asked about you, and before we could stop, we gave it away that we knew you, and then we ran away."
Lyra was hiding her face in her hands, pressing her head down against the pavement. Pantalaimon was flickering from shape to shape in his agitation. Dog, bird, cat, snow-white ermine.
"What did the man look like?"
"Big, and ever so strong, and pale eyes."
"Did he see you come back through the window?"
"No, but..."
"Well, he won't know where we are, then."
"But the alethiometer!"
she cried, and she sat up fiercely, her face rigid with emotion, like a Greek mask.
"Yeah. Tell me about that."
Between sobs and teeth grinding, she told him what had happened, how the old man had seen her using the alethiometer in the museum the day before, and how he'd stopped the car today and she'd got in to escape from the pale man, and how the car had pulled up on that side of the road so she'd had to climb past him to get out, and how he must have swiftly taken the alethiometer as he'd passed her the rucksack. He could see how devastated she was, but not why she should feel guilty. And then she said,
"And Will, please, I've done something very bad. Because the alethiometer told me I had to stop looking for dust. At least, I thought that's what it said. And I had to help you. I had to help you find your father. And I could take you to wherever he is if I had it. But I wouldn't listen. I'd just done what I wanted to do, and I shouldn't.
He'd seen her use it, and he knew it could tell her the truth. He turned away. She seized his wrist, but he broke away from her and walked to the edge of the water. The children were playing again across the harbour. Lyra ran up to him and said,
Will, I'm so sorry.
What's the use of that? I don't care if you're sorry or not, you did it.
But, Will, we've got to help each other, you and me, because there ain't anyone else.
I can't see how.
Nor can I, but...
She stopped in mid-sentence, and a light came into her eyes. She turned and raced back to her rucksack, abandoned on the pavement, and rummaged through it feverishly.
I know who he is, and where he lives. Look!
She said, and held up a little white card.
He gave this to me in a museum. We can go and get the alethiometer back!
Will took the card and read,
Sir Charles Latram, CBE. Limefield House, Old Headington, Oxford. He's a sir. A knight. That means people will automatically believe him and not us. What did you want me to do anyway? Go to the police? The police are after me. Or if they weren't yesterday, they will be by now. And if you go, they know who you are now, and they know you know me. So that wouldn't work either.
We could steal it. We could go to his house and steal it. I know where Headington is. There's a Headington in my Oxford, too. It ain't far. We could walk there in an hour, easy.
You're stupid.
Yorick Bernison would go there straight away and rip his head off. I wish he was here. He...
But she fell silent. Will was just looking at her, and she quailed. She would have quailed in the same way if the armoured bear had looked at her like that, because there was something not unlike Yorick in Will's eyes, young as they were.
I never heard anything so stupid in my life. You think we can just go to his house and creep in and steal it? You need to think. You need to use your bloody brain. He's going to have all kinds of burglar alarms and stuff if he's a rich man. There'll be bells that go off and special locks and lights with infrared switches that come on automatically.
I never heard of those things. We ain't gone in my world. I couldn't know that, Will.
All right, then. Think of this. He's got a whole house to hide it in. And how long would any burglar have to look through every cupboard and drawer and hiding place in a whole house? Those men who came to my house had hours to look around, and they never found what they were looking for. And I bet he's got a whole lot bigger house than we have. And probably a safe, too. So even if we did get into his house, we'd never find it in time before the police came.
She hung her head. It was all true.
What are we going to do, then?
He didn't answer. But it was we, for certain. He was bound to her now, whether he liked it or not. He walked to the water's edge, and back to the terrace, and back to the water again. He beat his hands together, looking for an answer, but no answer came, and he shook his head angrily.
Just... Go there. Just go there and see him. It's no good asking your scholar to help us either, not if the police have been to her. She's bound to believe them rather than us. At least if we get into his house, we'll see where the main rooms are. That'll be a start.
Without another word, he went inside and put the letters under the pillow in the room he'd slept in. Then, if he were caught, they'd never have them. Lyra was waiting on the terrace, with Pantalaimon perched on her shoulder as a sparrow. She was looking more cheerful.
We're going to get it back, all right. I can feel it.
He said nothing. They set off for the window. It took an hour and a half to walk to Headington. Lyra led the way, avoiding the city centre, and Will kept watch all around, saying nothing. It was much harder for Lyra now than it had been even in the Arctic, on the way to Bolvanger, for then she'd had the Egyptians and Yorick Bernison with her, and even if the tundra was full of danger, you knew the danger when you saw it. Here, in the city that was both hers and not hers, danger could look friendly and treachery smiled and smelled sweet. And even if they weren't going to kill her or part her from Pantalaimon, they had robbed her of her only guide. Without the alethiometer, she was just a little girl, lost. Limefield House was the colour of warm honey, and half of its front was covered in Virginia creeper. It stood in a large, well-tended garden with shrubbery at one side and a gravel drive sweeping up to the front door. The Rolls-Royce was parked in front of a double garage to the left. Everything Will could see spoke of wealth and power, the sort of informal, settled superiority that some upper-class English people still took for granted. There was something about it that made him grit his teeth, and he didn't know why, until suddenly he remembered an occasion when he was very young. His mother had taken him to a house not unlike this. They'd dressed in their best clothes, and he'd had to be on his best behavior, and an old man and woman had made his mother cry, and they'd left the house, and she was still crying. Lyra saw him breathing fast and clenching his fists, and was sensible enough not to ask why. It was something to do with him, not with her. Presently he took a deep breath.
Well, might as well try.
He walked up the drive, and Lyra followed close behind. They felt very exposed. The door had an old-fashioned bell pull, like those in Lyra's world, and Will didn't know where to find it till Lyra showed him. When they pulled it, the bell jangled a long way off inside the house. The man who opened the door was the servant who'd been driving the car, only now he didn't have his cap on. He looked at Will first, and then at Lyra, and his expression changed a little.
We want to see Sir Charles Latram.
His jaw was jutting as it had done last night, facing the stone-throwing children by the tower. The servant nodded.
Wait here. I'll tell Sir Charles.
He closed the door. It was solid oak, with two heavy locks and bolts top and bottom, though Will thought that no sensible burglar would try the front door anyway. And there was a burglar alarm prominently fixed at the front of the house, and a large spotlight at each corner. They'd never be able to get near it, let alone break in. Steady footsteps came to the door, and then it opened again. Will looked up at the face of this man, who had so much that he wanted even more, and found him disconcertingly smooth and calm and powerful, not in the least guilty or ashamed. Sensing Lyra beside him, impatient and angry, Will said quickly,
"Excuse me, but Lyra thinks when she had a lift in your car earlier on, she left something in it by mistake."
"Lyra? I don't know a Lyra. What an unusual name. I know a child called Lizzie. And who are you?"
Cursing himself for forgetting, Will said,
"I'm her brother, Mark."
"I see. Hello, Lizzie, or Lyra. You'd better come in."
He stood aside. Neither Will nor Lyra was quite expecting this, and they stepped inside uncertainly. The hall was dim and smelled of beeswax and flowers. Every surface was polished and clean, and a mahogany cabinet against the wall contained dainty porcelain figures. Will saw the servant standing in the background, as if he were waiting to be called.
"Come into my study,"
said Sir Charles, and held open another door off the hall. He was being courteous, even welcoming, but there was an edge to his manner that put Will on guard. The study was large and comfortable in a cigar-smoke and leather armchair sort of way, and seemed to be full of bookshelves, pictures, hunting trophies. There were three or four glass-fronted cabinets containing antique scientific instruments, brass microscopes, telescopes covered in green leather, sextants, compasses. It was clear why he wanted the alethiometer.
"Sit down,"
said Sir Charles, and indicated a leather sofa. He sat at the chair behind his desk and went on.
"Well, what have you got to say?"
"You stole..."
began Lyra hotly, but Will looked at her and she stopped.
"Lyra thinks she left something in your car. We've come to get it back."
"Is this the object you mean?"
he said, and took a velvet cloth from a drawer in the desk. Lyra stood up. He ignored her and unfolded the cloth, disclosing the golden splendor of the alethiometer resting in his palm.
"Yes!"
Lyra burst out, and reached for it. But he closed his hand. The desk was wide, and she couldn't reach, and before she could do anything else, he swung around and placed the alethiometer in a glass-fronted cabinet before locking it and dropping the key in his waistcoat pocket.
"But it isn't yours, Lizzie. Or Lyra, if that's your name."
"It is mine! It's my alethiometer!"
He shook his head sadly and heavily, as if he were reproaching her, and it was a sorrow to him, but he was doing it for her own good.
"I think at the very least there's considerable doubt about the matter."
"But it is hers. Honestly, she's shown it to me. I know it's hers."
"You see, I think you'd have to prove that. I don't have to prove anything, because it's in my possession. It's assumed to be mine, like all the other items in my collection. I must say, Lyra, I'm surprised to find you so dishonest."
"I ain't dishonest."
"Oh, but you are. You told me your name was Lizzie. Now I learn it's something else. Frankly, you haven't got a hope of convincing anyone that a precious piece like this belongs to you. I tell you what, let's call the police."
He turned his head to call for the servant.
No, wait,
said Will, before Sir Charles could speak. But Lyra ran around the desk, and from nowhere Pantalaimon was in her arms, a snarling wildcat baring his teeth and hissing at the old man. Sir Charles blinked at the sudden appearance of the demon, but hardly flinched.
You don't even know what it is you stole! You see me using it and you thought you'd steal it, and you did! But you're worse than my mother! At least she knows it's important! You're just going to put it in a case and do nothing with it! You ought to die! If I can, I'll make someone kill you! You're not worth leaving alive! You're...
She couldn't speak. All she could do was spit full in his face, so she did, with all her might. Will sat still, watching, looking around, memorizing where everything was. Sir Charles calmly shook out a silk handkerchief and mopped himself.
Have you any control over yourself? Go and sit down, you filthy brat.
Lyra felt tears shaken out of her eyes by the trembling of her body and threw herself onto the sofa. Pantalaimon, his thick cat's tail erect, stood on her lap with his blazing eyes fixed on the old man. Will sat silent and puzzled. Sir Charles could have thrown them out long before this. What was he playing at? And then he saw something so bizarre he thought he'd imagined it. Out of the sleeve of Sir Charles's linen jacket, past the snowy white shirt cuff, came the emerald head of a snake. Its black tongue flicked this way, that way, and its mailed head with its gold-rimmed black eyes moved from Lyra to Will and back again. She was too angry to see it at all, and Will saw it only for a moment before it retreated again up the old man's sleeve, but it made his eyes widen with shock. Sir Charles moved to the window seat and calmly sat down, arranging the crease in his trousers.
I think you'd better listen to me instead of behaving in this uncontrolled way. You really haven't any choice. The instrument is in my possession and will stay there. I want it. I'm a collector. You can spit and stamp and scream all you like, but by the time you've persuaded anyone else to listen to you, I shall have plenty of documents to prove that I bought it. I can do that very easily, and then you'll never get it back.
They were both silent now. He hadn't finished. A great puzzlement was slowing Lyra's heartbeat and making the room very still.
However, there's something I want even more, and I can't get it myself. So I'm prepared to make a deal with you. You fetch the object I want, and I'll give you back the, what did you call it?
A lithiometer.
A lithiometer? How interesting. A lithia. Truth. Those emblems. Yes, I see.
What's this thing you want, and where is it?
It's somewhere I can't go, but you can. I'm perfectly well aware that you've found a doorway somewhere. I guess it's not too far from Summertown, where I dropped Lizzie, or Lyra, this morning. And that through the doorway is another world. One with no grown-ups in it. Right so far? Well, you see, the man who made that doorway has got a knife. He's hiding in that other world right now, and he's extremely afraid. He has reason to be. If he's where I think he is, he's in an old stone tower with angels carved around the doorway. The Torre degli Angeli. So that's where you have to go. And I don't care how you do it, but I want that knife. Bring it to me, and you can have the alethiometer. I shall be sorry to lose it, but I'm a man of my word. That's what you have to do. Bring me the knife.
Chapter 8. The Tower of the Angels. Will said,
who is this man who's got the knife?
They were in the Rolls-Royce, driving up through Oxford. Sir Charles sat in the front, half turned around, and Will and Lyra sat in the back, with Pantalaimon a mouse now, soothed in Lyra's hands.
Someone who has no more right to the knife than I have to the alethiometer. Unfortunately for all of us, the alethiometer is in my possession and the knife is in his.
How do you know about the other world anyway?
I know many things that you don't. What else would you expect? I'm a good deal older and considerably better informed. There are a number of doorways between this world and that. Those who know where they are can easily pass back and forth. In Chitagatse, there's a guild of learned men, so-called, who used to do so all the time.
You ain't from this world at all. You're from there, ain't you?
And again came that strange nudge at her memory. She was almost certain she'd seen him before.
No, I'm not.
If we've got to get the knife from that man, we need to know more about him. He's not going to just give it to us, is he?
Certainly not. It's the one thing keeping the spectres away. It's not going to be easy by any means.
The spectres are afraid of the knife.
Very much so.
Why do they attack only grown-ups?
You don't need to know that now. It doesn't matter. Lyra,
Sir Charles said, turning to her,
tell me about your remarkable friend.
He meant Pantalaimon, and as soon as he said it, Will realized that the snake he'd seen concealed in the man's sleeve was a demon too, and that Sir Charles must come from Lyra's world. He was asking about Pantalaimon to put them off the track, so he didn't realize that Will had seen his own demon. Lyra lifted Pantalaimon close to her breast, and he became a black rat, whipping his tail around and around her wrist and glaring at Sir Charles with red eyes.
You weren't supposed to see him. He's my demon. You think you ain't got demons in this world, but you have. Yours would be a dung beetle.
If the pharaohs of Egypt were content to be represented by a scarab, so am I. Well, you're from yet another world. How interesting. Is that where the alethiometer comes from, or did you steal it on your travels?
I was given it! The master of Jordan College in my Oxford gave it to me. It's mine by right, and you wouldn't know what to do with it, you stupid, stinky old man. You'd never read it in 100 years. It's just a toy to you. But I need it, and so does Will. We'll get it back, don't worry.
We'll see. This is where I dropped you before. Shall we let you out here?
No,
said Will, because he could see a police car farther down the road.
You can't come into Jigatse because of the spectres. So it doesn't matter if you know where the window is. Take us farther up toward the ring road.
As you wish. When or if you get the knife, call my number and Alan will come to pick you up.
They said no more till the chauffeur drew the car to a halt. As they got out, Sir Charles lowered his window and said to Will,
By the way, if you can't get the knife, don't bother to return. Come to my house without it and I'll call the police. I imagine they'll be there at once. When I tell them your real name... It is William Parry, isn't it? Yes, I thought so. There's a very good photo of you in today's paper.
And the car pulled away. Will was speechless. Lyra was shaking his arm.
It's all right. He won't tell anyone else. He would have done it already if he was going to. Come on!
10 minutes later, they stood in the little square at the foot of the Tower of the Angels. Will had told her about the snake demon, and she had stopped still in the street, tormented again by that half-memory. Who was the old man? Where had she seen him? It was no good. The memory wouldn't come clear.
I didn't want to tell him, but I saw a man up there last night. He looked down when the kids were making all that noise.
What did he look like?
Young, with curly hair. Not old at all. But I saw him for only a moment, at the very top, over those battlements. I thought he might be... You remember Angelica and Paolo... And Paolo said they had an older brother, and he'd come into the city as well. And she made Paolo stop telling us, as if it was a secret. Well, I thought it might be him. He might be after this knife as well. And I reckon all the kids know about it. I think that's the real reason why they come back in the first place.
He said, looking up.
Maybe.
She remembered the children talking earlier that morning. No children would go in the tower, they'd said. There were scary things in there. And she remembered her own feeling of unease as she and Pantalaimon had looked through the open door before leaving the city. Maybe that was why they needed a grown man to go in there. Her demon was fluttering around her head now, moth-formed in the bright sunlight, whispering anxiously.
Hush!
She whispered back.
There ain't any choice, Pan. It's our fault. We've got to make it right, and this is the only way.
Will walked off to the right, following the wall of the tower. At the corner, a narrow cobbled alley led between it and the next building. And Will went down there, too, looking up, getting the measure of the place. Lyra followed. Will stopped under a window at the second-story level and said to Pantalaimon,
Can you fly up there? Can you look in?
He became a sparrow at once and set off. He could only just reach it. Lyra gasped and gave a little cry when he was at the windowsill, and he perched there for a second or two before diving down again. She sighed and took deep breaths like someone rescued from drowning. Will frowned, puzzled.
It's hard... When your demon goes away from you, it hurts.
Oh, sorry. Did you see anything?
Stairs. Stairs and dark rooms. There were swords hung on the wall, and spears and shields, like a museum. and I saw the young man. He was dancing.
Dancing?
Moving to and fro, waving his hand about, or as if he was fighting something invisible. I just saw him through an open door, not clearly.
Fighting a spectre?
Lyra guessed, but they couldn't guess any better, so they moved on. Behind the tower, a high stone wall, topped with broken glass, enclosed a small garden with formal beds of herbs around a fountain. Once again, Pantalaimon flew up to look, and then there was an alley on the other side, bringing them back to the square. The windows around the tower were small and deeply set, like frowning eyes.
We'll have to go in the front, then,
said Will. He climbed the steps and pushed the door wide. Sunlight struck in, and the heavy hinges creaked. He took a step or two inside, and seeing no one, went in further. Lyra followed close behind. The floor was made of flagstones worn smooth over centuries, and the air inside was cool. Will looked at a flight of steps going downward, and went far enough down to see that it opened into a wide, low-ceilinged room with an immense cold furnace at one end, where the plaster walls were black with soot. But there was no one there, and he went up to the entrance hall again, where he found Lyra with her finger to her lips, looking up.
I can hear him. He's talking to himself, I reckon.
Will listened hard and heard it too. A low crooning murmur interrupted occasionally by a harsh laugh or a short cry of anger. It sounded like the voice of a madman. Will blew out his cheeks and set off to climb the staircase. It was made of blackened oak, immense and broad, with steps as worn as the flagstones, far too solid to creak underfoot. The light diminished as they climbed because the only illumination was the small, deep-set window on each landing. They climbed up one floor, stopped and listened, climbed the next, and the sound of the man's voice was now mixed with that of halting, rhythmic footsteps. It came from a room across the landing, whose door stood ajar. Will tiptoed to it and pushed it open another few inches so he could see. It was a large room with cobwebs thickly clustered on the ceiling. The walls were lined with bookshelves containing badly preserved volumes with the bindings crumbling and flaking or distorted with damp. Several of them lay thrown off the shelves, open on the floor or the wide, dusty tables, and others had been thrust back higgledy-piggledy. In the center of the room, a young man was dancing. Pantalaimon was right. It looked exactly like that. He had his back to the door, and he'd shuffled to one side, then to the other, and all the time his right hand moved in front of him as if he were clearing a way through some invisible obstacles. In that hand was a knife, not a special-looking knife, just a dull blade about 8 inches long, and he'd thrust it forward, slice it sideways, feel forward with it, jab up and down, all in the empty air. He moved as if to turn, and Will withdrew. He put a finger to his lips and beckoned to Lyra, and led her to the stairs and up to the next floor.
What's he doing?
He described it as well as he could.
He sounds mad. Is he thin? With curly hair?
Yes. Red hair, like Angelica's. He certainly looks mad. I don't know. I think this is odder than Sir Charles said. Let's look farther up before we speak to him.
She didn't question, but let him lead them up another staircase to the top story. It was much lighter up there, because a white-painted flight of steps led up to the roof, or rather to a wood and glass structure like a little greenhouse. Even at the foot of the steps they could feel the heat it was absorbing. And as they stood there they heard a groan from above. They jumped. They'd been sure there was only one man in the tower. Pantalaimon was so startled that he changed at once from a cat to a bird, and flew to Lyra's breast. Will and Lyra realized as he did so that they'd seized each other's hand, and let go slowly.
Better go and see. I'll go first.
I ought to go first. Seeing it's my fault.
Seeing it's your fault, you've got to do as I say.
She twisted her lip, but fell in behind him. He climbed up into the sun. The light in the glass structure was blinding. It was as hot as a greenhouse, too, and Will could neither see nor breathe easily. He found a door handle and turned it and stepped out quickly, holding his hand up to keep the sun out of his eyes. He found himself on a roof of lead, enclosed by the battlemented parapet. The glass structure was set in the centre, and the lead sloped slightly downward all round toward a gutter inside the parapet, with square drainage holes in the stone for rainwater. Lying on the lead, in the full sun, was an old man with white hair. His face was bruised and battered, and one eye was closed, and as they saw when they got closer, his hands were tied behind him. He heard them coming and groaned again and tried to turn over to shield himself.
It's all right. We aren't going to hurt you. Did the man with the knife do this?
The old man grunted.
Let's undo the rope. He hasn't tied it very well.
It was clumsily and hastily knotted, and it fell away quickly once Will had seen how to work it. They helped the old man to get up and took him over to the shade of the parapet.
Who are you? We didn't think there were two people here. We thought there was only one.
Giacomo Palandisi,
the old man muttered through broken teeth.
I am the bearer, no one else. That young man stole it from me. There are always fools who take risks like that for the sake of the knife, but this one is desperate. He is going to kill me.
No, he ain't. What's the bearer? What's that mean?
I hold this subtle knife on behalf of the guild. Where has he gone?
He's downstairs. We came up past him. He didn't see us. He was waving it about in the air.
Trying to cut through. He won't succeed when he...
Watch out!
Will turned. The young man was climbing up into the little wooden shelter. He hadn't seen them yet, but there was nowhere to hide. And as they stood up, he saw the movement and whipped around to face them. Immediately Pantalaimon became a bear and reared up on his hind legs. Only Lyra knew that he wouldn't be able to touch the other man, and certainly the other blinked and stared for a second, but Will saw that he hadn't really registered it. The man was crazy. His curly red hair was matted, his chin was flecked with spit, and the whites of his eyes showed all around the pupils. And he had the knife, and they had no weapons at all. Will stepped up the lead, away from the old man, crouching, ready to jump or fight or leap out of the way. The young man sprang forward and slashed at him with the knife, left, right, left, coming closer and closer, making Will back away till he was trapped in the angle where two sides of the tower met. Lyra was scrambling towards the man from behind with the loose rope in her hand. Will darted forward suddenly, just as he'd done to the man in his house, and with the same effect. His antagonist tumbled backwards unexpectedly, falling over Lyra to crash onto the lead. It was all happening too quickly for Will to be frightened, but he did have time to see the knife fly from the man's hand and sink at once into the lead some feet away, point first, with no more resistance than if it had fallen into butter. It plunged as far as the hilt and stopped suddenly. And the young man twisted over and reached for it at once, but Will flung himself on his back and seized his hair. He had learned to fight at school. There had been plenty of occasion for it once the other children had sensed that there was something the matter with his mother. And he'd learned that the object of a school fight was not to gain points for style, but to force your enemy to give in, which meant hurting him more than he was hurting you. He knew that you had to be willing to hurt someone else, too, and he'd found out that not many people were when it came to it. But he knew that he was. So this wasn't unfamiliar to him, but he hadn't fought against a nearly grown man armed with a knife before, and at all costs he must keep the man from picking it up now that he'd dropped it. Will twisted his fingers into the young man's thick, damp hair and wrenched back as hard as he could. The man grunted and flung himself sideways, but Will hung on even tighter, and his opponent roared with pain and anger. He pushed up and then threw himself backwards, crushing Will between himself and the parapet, and that was too much. All the breath left Will's body, and in the shock his hands loosened. The man pulled free. Will dropped to his knees in the gutter, winded badly, but he couldn't stay there. He tried to stand, and in doing so he thrust his foot through one of the drainage holes. His fingers scraped desperately on the warm lead, and for a horrible second he thought he would slide off the roof to the ground. But nothing happened. His left leg was thrust out into empty space. The rest of him was safe. He pulled his leg back inside the parapet and scrambled to his feet. The man had reached his knife again, but he didn't have time to pull it out of the lead before Lyra leapt onto his back, scratching, kicking, biting like a wildcat. But she missed the hold on his hair that she was trying for, and he threw her off. And when he got up, he had the knife in his hand. Lyra had fallen to one side, with Pantalaimon a wildcat now, fur raised, teeth bared beside her. Will faced the man directly and saw him clearly for the first time. There was no doubt. He was Angelica's brother, all right, and he was vicious. All his mind was focused on Will, and the knife was in his hand. But Will wasn't harmless, either. He'd seized the rope when Lyra dropped it, and now he wrapped it around his left hand for protection against the knife. He moved sideways between the young man and the sun, so that his antagonist had to squint and blink. Even better, the glass structure threw brilliant reflections into his eyes, and Will could see that for a moment he was almost blinded. He leapt to the man's left, away from the knife, holding his left hand high, and kicked hard at the man's knee. He'd taken care to aim, and his foot connected well. The man went down with a loud grunt and twisted away awkwardly. Will leapt after him, kicking again and again, kicking whatever parts he could reach, driving the man back and back towards the glass house. If he could get him to the top of the stairs. This time the man fell more heavily, and his right hand, with the knife in it, came down on the lead at Will's feet. Will stamped on it at once, hard, crushing the man's fingers between the hilt and the lead, and then wrapped the rope more tightly around his hand and stamped a second time. The man yelled and let go of the knife. At once Will kicked it away, his shoe connecting with the hilt, luckily for him, and it spun across the lead and came to rest in the gutter just beside a drainage hole. The rope had come loose around his hand once more, and there seemed to be a surprising amount of blood from somewhere sprinkled on the lead and on his own shoes. The man was pulling himself up.
"Look out!"
shouted Lyra, but Will was ready. At the moment when the man was off balance, he threw himself at him, crashing as hard as he could into the man's midriff. The man fell backward into the glass, which shattered at once, and the flimsy wooden frame went too. He sprawled among the wreckage, half over the stairwell, and grabbed the door frame, but it had nothing to support it any more, and it gave way. He fell downward, and more glass fell all around him. And Will darted back to the gutter and picked up the knife, and the fight was over. The young man, cut and battered, clambered up the step and saw Will standing above him, holding the knife. He stared with a sickly anger and then turned and fled. Said Will, sitting down. Something was badly wrong, and he hadn't noticed it. He dropped the knife and hugged his left hand to himself. The tangle of rope was sodden with blood, and when he pulled it away...
Your fingers! Oh, Will!
His little finger and the finger next to it fell away with the rope. His head swam. Blood was pulsing strongly from the stumps where his fingers had been, and his jeans and shoes were sodden already. He had to lie back and close his eyes for a moment. The pain wasn't that great, and a part of his mind registered that with a dull surprise. It was like a persistent, deep hammer thud more than the bright, sharp clarity when you cut yourself superficially. He'd never felt so weak. He supposed he had gone to sleep for a moment. Lyra was doing something to his arm. He sat up to look at the damage and felt sick. The old man was somewhere close by, but Will couldn't see what he was doing, and meanwhile Lyra was talking to him.
If only we had some blood moss, what the bears use, I could make it better, Will, I could. Look, I'm going to tie this bit of rope around your arm to stop the bleeding, because I can't tie it around where your fingers were. There's nothing to tie it to. Hold still.
He let her do it, then looked around for his fingers. There they were, curled like a bloody quotation mark on the lead. He laughed.
Hey, stop that. Get up now. Mr. Paradisi's got some medicine, some salve. I don't know what it is. You've got to come downstairs. The other man's gone. We've seen him run out the door. He's gone now. You beat him. Come on, Will. Come on.
Nagging and cajoling, she urged him down the steps, and they picked their way through the shattered glass and splintered wood and into a small, cool room off the landing. The walls were lined with shelves of bottles, jars, pots, pestles and mortars, and chemist's balances. Under the dirty window was a stone sink, where the old man was pouring something with a shaky hand from a large bottle into a smaller one.
"Sit down and drink this," he said, and filled a small glass with a dark golden liquid.
Will sat down and took the glass. The first mouthful hit the back of his throat like fire. Lyra took the glass to stop it from falling as Will gasped.
"Drink it all."
"What is it?"
"Plum brandy. Drink."
Will sipped it more cautiously. Now his hand was really beginning to hurt.
"Can you heal him?"
"Oh, yes. We have medicines for everything. You, girl, open the drawer in the table and bring out a bandage."
Will saw the knife lying on the table in the center of the room, but before he could pick it up, the old man was limping towards him with a bowl of water.
"Drink again."
Will held the glass tightly and closed his eyes while the old man did something to his hand. It stung horribly, but then he felt the rough friction of a towel on his wrist and something mopping the wound more gently. Then there was a coolness for a moment, and it hurt again.
"This is precious ointment. Very difficult to obtain. Very good for wounds."
It was a dusty, battered tube of ordinary antiseptic cream, such as Will could have bought in any pharmacy in his world. The old man was handling it as if it were made of myrrh. Will looked away. And while the man was dressing the wound, Lyra felt Pantalaimon calling to her silently to come and look out the window. He was a kestrel perching on the open window frame, and his eyes had caught a movement below. She joined him and saw a familiar figure. The girl Angelica was running towards her elder brother Tullio, who stood with his back against the wall on the other side of the narrow street, waving his arms in the air as if trying to keep a flock of bats from his face. Then he turned away and began to run his hands along the stones in the wall, looking closely at each one, counting them, feeling the edges, hunching up his shoulders as if to ward off something behind him, shaking his head. Angelica was desperate, and so was little Paolo behind her, and they reached their brother and seized his arms and tried to pull him away from whatever was troubling him. And Lyra realized with a jolt of sickness what was happening. The man was being attacked by specters. Angelica knew it, though she couldn't see them, of course, and little Paola was crying and striking at the empty air to try and drive them off. But it didn't help, and Tullio was lost. His movements became more and more lethargic, and presently they stopped altogether. Angelica clung to him, shaking and shaking his arm, but nothing woke him, and Paola was crying his brother's name over and over as if that would bring him back. Then Angelica seemed to feel Lyra watching her, and she looked up. For a moment their eyes met. Lyra felt a jolt as if the girl had struck her a physical blow, because the hatred in her eyes was so intense. And then Paola saw her looking and looked up too, and his little boy's voice cried,
"We'll kill you! You've done this to Tullio! We're going to kill you, all right!"
The two children turned and ran, leaving their stricken brother. And Lyra, frightened and guilty, withdrew inside the room again and shut the window. The others hadn't heard. Giacomo Paradisi was dabbing more ointment on the wounds, and Lyra tried to put what she'd seen out of her mind and focused on Will.
"You've got to tie something around his arm to stop the bleeding. It won't stop otherwise."
"Yes, yes, I know."
Will kept his eyes averted while he did up a bandage and drank the plum brandy sip by sip. Presently he felt soothed and distant, though his hand was hurting abominably.
"Now, here you are. Take the knife. It is yours."
"I don't want it. I don't want anything to do with it."
"You haven't got the choice. You are the bearer now."
"I thought you said you was..."
"My time is over. The knife knows when to leave one hand and settle in another, and I know how to tell. You don't believe me? Look."
He held up his own left hand. The little finger and the finger next to it were missing, just like Will's.
"Yes, me too. I fought and lost the same fingers, the badge of the bearer, and I did not know either in advance."
Lyra sat down, wide-eyed. Will held on to the dusty table with his good hand. He struggled to find words.
"But we only came here because there was a man who stole something of Lyra's, and he wanted the knife, and he said if we brought him that, then he..."
"I know that man. He is a liar, a cheat. He won't give you anything. Make no mistake. He wants the knife, and once he has it, he will betray you. He will never be the bearer. The knife is yours by right."
With a heavy reluctance, Will turned to the knife itself. He pulled it towards him. It was an ordinary-looking dagger with a double-sided blade of dull metal about 8 inches long, a short crosspiece of the same metal, and a handle of rosewood. As he looked at it more closely, he saw that the rosewood was inlaid with golden wires, forming a design he didn't recognize till he turned the knife around and saw an angel with wings folded. On the other side was a different angel with wings upraised. The wires stood out a little from the surface, giving a firm grip, and as he picked it up he felt that it was light in his hand and strong and beautifully balanced, and that the blade was not dull after all. In fact, a swirl of cloudy colors seemed to live just under the surface of the metal. Bruise purples, sea blues, earth browns, cloud greys, the deep green under heavy foliage trees, the clustering shades at the mouth of a tomb as evening falls over a deserted graveyard. If there was such a thing as shadow-colored, it was the blade of the subtle knife. But the edges were different. In fact, the two edges differed from each other. One was clear, bright steel, merging a little way back into those subtle shadow colors, but steel of an incomparable sharpness. Will's eye shrank back from looking at it, so sharp did it seem. The other edge was just as keen, but silvery in color, and Lyra, who was looking at it over Will's shoulder, said,
"I've seen that color before. That's the same as the blade they was going to cut me and Pan apart with. That's just the same."
"This edge,"
said Giacomo Paradisi, touching the steel with the handle of a spoon,
"will cut through any material in the world. Look."
And he pressed the silver spoon against the blade. Will, holding the knife, felt only the slightest resistance as the tip of the spoon's handle fell to the table, cut clean off.
"The other edge is more subtle still. With it, you can cut an opening out of this world altogether. Try it now. Do as I say. You are the bearer. You have to know. No one can teach you but me, and I have not much time left. Stand up and listen."
Will pushed his chair back and stood, holding the knife loosely. He felt dizzy, sick, rebellious.
I don't want...
he began, but Giacomo Paradisi shook his head.
Be silent. You don't want, you don't want. You have no choice. Listen to me, because time is short. Now, hold the knife out ahead of you. Like that. It's not only the knife that has to cut, it's your own mind. You have to think it. So do this. Put your mind out at the very tip of the knife. Concentrate, boy. Focus your mind. Don't think about your wound. It will heal. Think about the knife tip. That is where you are. Now, feel with it very gently. You're looking for a gap so small you could never see it with your eyes. But the knife tip will find it if you put your mind there. Feel along the air till you sense the smallest little gap in the world.
Will tried to do it, but his head was buzzing and his left hand throbbed horribly, and he saw his two fingers again lying on the roof. And then he thought of his mother, his poor mother. What would she say? How would she comfort him? How could he ever comfort her? And he put the knife down on the table and crouched low, hugging his wounded hand, and cried. It was all too much to bear. The sobs racked his throat and his chest, and the tears dazzled him. And he should be crying for her, the poor, frightened, unhappy, dear beloved. He'd left her. He'd left her. He was desolate. But then he felt the strangest thing, and brushed the back of his right wrist across his eyes to find Pantalaimon's head on his knee. The demon, in the form of a wolfhound, was gazing up at him with melting, sorrowing eyes, and then he gently licked Will's wounded hand again and again, and laid his head on Will's knee once more. Will had no idea of the taboo in Lyra's world, preventing one person from touching another's demon. And if he hadn't touched Pantalaimon before, it was politeness that had held him back and not knowledge. Lyra, in fact, was breathtaken. Her demon had done it on his own initiative, and now he withdrew and fluttered to her shoulder as the smallest of moths. The old man was watching, with interest but not incredulity. He'd seen demons before, somehow. He'd travelled to other worlds, too. Pantalaimon's gesture had worked. Will swallowed hard and stood up again, wiping the tears out of his eyes.
All right. I'll try again. Tell me what to do.
This time he forced his mind to do what Giacomo Paradisi said, gritting his teeth, trembling with exertion, sweating. Lyra was bursting to interrupt, because she knew this process. So did Dr. Malone, and so did the poet Keats, whoever he was, and all of them knew you couldn't get it by straining towards it. But she held her tongue and clasped her hands.
Stop! Relax! Don't push! This is a subtle knife, not a heavy sword. You're gripping it too tight. Loosen your fingers. Let your mind wander down your arm to your wrist and then into the handle and out along the blade. No hurry. Go gently. Don't force it. Just wander. Then along to the very tip where the edge is sharpest of all. You become the tip of the knife. Just do that now. Go there and feel that. And then... come back.
Will tried again. Lyra could see the intensity in his body, saw his jaw working, and then saw an authority descend over it, calming and relaxing and clarifying. The authority was Will's own, or his demon's, perhaps. How he must miss having a demon? The loneliness of it. No wonder he'd cried. And it was right of Pantalaimon to do what he'd done, though it had felt so strange to her. She reached up to her beloved demon, and, ermine-shaped, he flowed onto her lap. They watched together as Will's body stopped trembling. No less intense, he was focused differently now, and the knife looked different, too. Perhaps it was those cloudy colours along the blade, or perhaps it was the way it sat so naturally in Will's hand, but the little movements he was making with the tip now looked purposeful instead of random. He felt this way, then turned the knife over and felt the other, always feeling with the silvery edge. And then he seemed to find some little snag in the empty air.
What's this? Is this it?
Yes. Don't force it. Come back now. Come back to yourself.
Lyra imagined she could see Will's soul flowing back along the blade to his hand and up his arm to his heart. He stood back, dropped his hand, blinked.
I felt something.